Sophist, a dialogue of Socrates with Theodorus, visitor, Theaetetus, and stranger.
Here we are, Socrates, right on schedule after yesterday's agreement, and we've brought this gentleman with us, a visitor from Elea, one of the circle around Parmenides and Zeno, and very much a philosopher.
Then perhaps, Theodorus, it isn't a visitor you've brought but some god without realizing it, as Homer has it. He says the gods, and not least the god of strangers, accompany men who have a decent sense of respect, watching over the outrages and the good order of mankind. So maybe this companion of yours is one of those higher powers, come to observe and expose how feeble we are in argument, a sort of god of refutation.
That's not our visitor's style, Socrates. He's more moderate than the people who make a serious business of quarreling. And in my view, the man is no god at all, though he is godlike. That's what I call all philosophers.
And rightly so, my friend. But that breed, I suspect, is hardly easier to make out than the gods. These men, the genuine philosophers, not the counterfeits, appear in all sorts of guises, thanks to everyone else's ignorance as they roam from city to city, looking down from above on the life below. To some people they seem worth nothing at all, to others worth everything. Sometimes they show up looking like statesmen, sometimes like sophists, and sometimes they can give the impression of being completely out of their minds. But I'd be glad to ask our visitor, if he doesn't mind, what the people in his part of the world thought about all this, and what names they used.
What things do you mean?
Sophist, statesman, philosopher.
What exactly is your difficulty about them? What sort of question did you have in mind?
This, did they consider all these to be one thing or two? Or did they distinguish three kinds, matching the three names, and attach one kind to each name?
I don't imagine he'll begrudge going through it, or how shall we put it, sir?
Just so, Theodorus. I don't begrudge it at all, and it's not hard to say that they counted them as three. But to define clearly what each of them is, that is no small task, and no easy one.
As luck would have it, Socrates, you've hit on questions very like the ones we happened to be pressing him with before we came here. And he made the same excuses to us then that he's making to you now, though he admits he has heard the whole matter thoroughly and hasn't forgotten it.
Then don't refuse us, sir, the first favor we ask. Just tell us this much. Which do you generally prefer, to work through what you want to demonstrate on your own, in one long speech, or to do it through questions? That was the method I once saw Parmenides use, developing some magnificent arguments when I was young and he was already a very old man.
With a partner who responds easily and gives no trouble, Socrates, the way with another person is easier. Otherwise, the way by oneself.
Then you may choose whomever you like from the company. They'll all answer you good-naturedly. But if you take my advice, you'll pick one of the young ones, Theaetetus here, or any of the others who suits you.
Socrates, meeting you all for the first time as I am, I feel a certain embarrassment about turning our gathering into a long solo performance, spinning out an extended speech by myself, or even addressing one to someone else, as if I were putting on a display. For the question, as you've just put it, is really not as small as one might hope from the way it was asked. It needs a very long discussion. On the other hand, to refuse you and these gentlemen, especially after what you've said, strikes me as unfriendly to a guest, even barbarous. As for Theaetetus, I accept him gladly as my partner in the discussion, both from my own earlier conversation with him and from your recommendation just now.
Then do that, sir, and as Socrates said, you'll be doing us all a favor.
There's probably nothing more to be said on that point, Theaetetus. From here on, it seems, the discussion is to be with you. And if the length of it wears you down and becomes a burden, don't blame me, blame these friends of yours.
I don't think I'll give out just yet. But if anything like that does happen, we'll bring in this other Socrates here, Socrates' namesake, my own age mate and training partner. Sharing hard work with me is nothing new to him.
Well said, you can decide that privately as the discussion goes on. But together with me you must now investigate, beginning, so it seems to me, with the sophist, searching him out and making plain in words what on earth he is. At present, you see, you and I share only the name where he's concerned. The thing we each call by it we may well hold privately, each to ourselves. But on every subject one should always agree on the thing itself, through reasoned discussion, rather than on the mere name without any account. Now the tribe we're proposing to hunt is not the easiest thing in the world to grasp, the sophist. And in all great undertakings that have to be worked through properly, everyone has long agreed on the rule. Practice first on small and easier cases before tackling the biggest ones. So here is my advice for the two of us, Theotatus. Since we've judged the sophist's kind a hard quarry to catch, let's first rehearse the method of hunting him on something easier, unless you can suggest some smoother road from somewhere.
I can't.
Then shall we go after some trivial thing and try to set it up as a model for the greater one?
Yes.
What might we put forward that's easy to know and small, yet allows an account no less than the bigger subjects do? Say, an angler. Isn't he familiar to everyone and hardly worth any great seriousness?
Just so.
And yet I expect he offers us a method and an account not unsuited to our purpose.
That would be good.
Come on then, let's start with him from this end. Tell me, shall we set him down as a man with an art, or as someone without an art but having some other capacity?
Without an art, certainly not.
Well, of arts taken altogether, there are pretty much two kinds.
How so?
Farming and all tending of any mortal body, then everything to do with what is compounded and fashioned, what we call an implement, and the art of imitation. All of these together would most justly be called by a single name.
How and by what name?
Whenever someone brings into being something that did not exist before, we say the one who brings it is making, and the thing brought is being made.
Right.
And all the things we just went through had their capacity directed to exactly that.
They did indeed.
Then let's sum them up and call them the productive art.
Agreed.
Next after this, the whole class of learning and of getting to know things, and money-making, contest, and hunting. Since none of these creates anything, but they take things that are or have come to be, capturing some of them by words and deeds, and refusing to let others be captured. For all these reasons, every one of these parts would most fittingly be called a certain art of acquisition.
Yes, that would fit.
So with all arts falling under acquisition or production, in which shall we place angling, Theotetus?
Under acquisition, obviously.
And aren't there two kinds of acquisitive art? One is exchange between willing parties, through gifts and hire and purchase. The rest, which captures things either by deeds or by words, would be the art of capture.
So it appears from what we've said.
Well then, shouldn't capture be cut in two?
Where?
Setting down all the open kind as contest, and all the secret kind as hunting.
Yes.
And it would be unreasonable not to cut hunting in two as well.
Say how?
Dividing off one part for the lifeless class, and one for the living.
Of course, if both exist.
How could they not exist? And we should let the hunting of lifeless things go. It has no name, apart from some parts of diving and a few other trifles like that, and call the other, since it is the hunting of living creatures, animal hunting.
So be it.
And of animal hunting mightn't we fairly say there's a double form, one for the walking kind, divided into many forms and names, land hunting, and the other for the swimming animal, all of it water hunting.
Certainly.
And of the swimming kind, we see one tribe is winged, and one lives in the water.
Naturally.
And all hunting of the winged class is called, I suppose, fowling.
So it is.
While that of the water class, taken pretty much as a whole, is fishing.
Yes.
Well now, mightn't we divide this hunting in turn into two main parts?
Which ones?
According as one does its hunting with enclosures on the spot, and the other with a strike.
What do you mean? How are you dividing each?
The first, whatever surrounds a thing and hems it in so as to block its escape, it's natural to call an enclosure.
Quite so.
Then wheels and nets and nooses and traps and things like that, should they be called anything but enclosures?
Nothing else.
So we'll call this part of the chase enclosure hunting, or something like that.
Yes.
But the part done with hooks and tridents by striking is different from that, and we should now call it in one word strike hunting, unless someone can say it better, Theaetetus.
Let's not worry about the name. That one will do.
Of strike hunting, then, the nighttime sort done by firelight has come to be called by the hunters themselves, as it happens, fire hunting.
Certainly.
While the daytime sort, since tridents too have hooks on their points, is all hook hunting.
So it's called.
Then of the strike hunting that uses hooks, the kind that goes from above downward, since that's chiefly how tridents are used, has been named, I believe, tridentry.
Some people do say so, at any rate.
And then there remains, one might say, only one form left.
What's that?
In the opposite kind of stroke, the one done with a hook, and not catching the fish wherever on the body it happens to, the way the three-pronged spear does, but always around the head and mouth of the creature being hunted, and hauled up from below, upward and against the pull, with rods and reeds, what shall we say this ought to be called, Theaetetus?
I think what we just now set out to find has now, this very thing, been completed.
So now you and I have agreed about angling not only its name, but we have grasped an adequate account of the practice itself. Of the whole of art, half was acquisitive, of the acquisitive, the part that overpowers by force, of that, the part that hunts, of hunting, the part that hunts living things, of that, the part that hunts things in water, of that, the whole lower division was fishing, of fishing, the part that strikes, and of striking, the part that uses a hook. The part of this that involves the upward stroke drawing up from below has, from the very practice itself, taken on a name resembling it, and this is what has come to be called in our search, angling.
That much, at any rate, has been shown sufficiently.
Come then, let us try, following this same model, to find out what on earth the sophist is.
By all means.
And indeed, that was the very first question, whether we should take the angler to be a layman or someone possessing an art.
Yes.
And now, Theaetetus, shall we set this one down as a layman, or as, in every sense, truly a sophist?
By no means a layman, I understand what you mean, that whoever bears this name must be everything such a name implies.
Then we must set him down as possessing some art, it seems.
What art, then, could this be?
Good heavens, have we failed to notice that the two men are kin to each other?
Kin of whom to whom?
The angler to the sophist.
How so?
Both appear to me to be a kind of hunter.
A hunter of what? The second one. We have already named the first.
We divided all hunting just now into two, cutting off a swimming part and a part on land.
Yes.
And we went through the one as much as concerns swimming water creatures, but the land part we left uncut, saying only that it was of many kinds.
Quite so.
Up to this point, then, the sophist and the angler travel together from the art of acquisition.
They do seem to.
But they part ways from the hunting of living things, the one turning toward the sea, rivers, and lakes to hunt the creatures in these.
Of course.
The other turns toward the land and toward other rivers, so to speak, boundless meadows of wealth and youth, meaning to master the creatures that graze there.
What do you mean?
Land hunting turns out to have two very large divisions.
What are they, each of them?
One is of tame creatures, the other of wild.
Is there, then, a hunting of tame creatures?
Yes, if man is a tame animal, but set it down however you please, whether you say no creature is tame, or that some other is tame but man is wild, or again that man is tame but deny there is any hunting of men. Whichever of these you find agreeable, define it for us.
Well, I take us to be a tame animal, stranger, and I say there is indeed a hunting of men.
Then let us say that the hunting of tame creatures, too, is twofold.
On what grounds?
Let us define piracy, slave trading, tyranny, and the whole art of war, all as one thing hunting by force.
Well put.
In courtroom pleading, public speaking, and persuasive conversation, let us call, taken all together, a single art some art of persuasion.
Correct.
Now of persuasion, let us say there are two kinds.
What kinds?
One happening in private, the other in public.
Yes, each is indeed a distinct kind.
And of private hunting, is not one part paid for hire, the other given as a gift?
I don't follow.
You haven't yet turned your mind, it seems, to the hunting done by lovers.
Concerning what?
That they give gifts in addition to those they hunt.
Very true.
Well then, let this be a kind of the erotic art.
Quite so.
But of the part paid for hire, the part that keeps company through charm, making its bait entirely out of pleasure, and exacts as its wage only its own upkeep, this, I think, we would all call flattery or some art of pleasing.
How could we not?
But the part that professes to keep company for the sake of virtue, and exacts money as its wage, doesn't this kind deserve to be called by another name?
How could it not?
What name, then, try to say?
It's obvious, I think we've found the sophist. So having said this, I think it is the fitting name to call him.
Then following our present account, Theaetetus, it seems the art that is appropriative, overpowering, acquisitive, hunting, hunting of living things, hunting on land, hunting on dry land, hunting of tame creatures, hunting of men, hunting by persuasion, hunting in private, hired, paid in coin, offering education as its lure, hunting the young and rich and prominent, this, as our present account turns out, must be called the sophistic art.
Absolutely.
But let us also look at it this way, for what we are now investigating is not a share of some paltry art, but of a very intricate one. And indeed, in what has been said already, it presents an appearance of being not this thing we now claim it to be, but some other kind.
How so?
The art of acquisition was, we said, double in form, one part having to do with hunting, the other with exchange.
Yes, it was.
Then let us say there are two kinds of exchange, one by gift, the other by purchase.
Let it be said.
And further, let us say that purchase and sale is cut in two.
How?
Dividing off the selling of one's own products as direct selling, and the trading of others' products as trade.
Quite so.
Well then, of trade, isn't the exchange within a single city, roughly half of it, called retailing?
Yes.
And the part that exchanges by buying and selling from one city to another, commerce.
Of course.
And of commerce, haven't we noticed that one part deals in goods by which the body is fed and served, the other in goods by which the soul is selling these two, in exchange for coin?
What do you mean by this?
The part concerning the soul we perhaps do not yet understand, since the other part, at least, we do grasp.
Yes.
Let us then speak of the whole of music bought at one city each time and carried elsewhere to be sold, and painting and puppetry and many other things pertaining to the soul, some brought and sold for the sake of amusement, others for the sake of earnest matters, and let us say that the one who brings and sells these could rightly be called a merchant, no less than the seller of food and drink.
Very true.
Then won't you apply the same name to the one who buys up items of learning, going from city to city, exchanging them for money?
Very much so.
Of this soul trading business, wouldn't one part most justly be called a display art, while the other no less absurd than the first, yet still, since it is a selling of learning, must be called by some name akin to the practice?
Certainly.
Then of this learning selling art, one part concerning the learning of the other arts must be given one name, and the part concerning virtue another.
How could it not?
Art selling would surely fit the part concerning the other arts, but as for the name for the part concerning these matters, virtue, please make an effort to state it yourself.
And what other name could one give, without erring, besides saying that this very thing being sought is the sophistic kind itself?
None other, come then, let us now gather it together, saying, the sophistic art has appeared, a second time as that part of the art of acquisition, exchange, purchase and sale, commerce and sole trading, which deals in words and lessons concerning virtue.
Quite so.
And a third time, I think, you would also call by this same name any man settled within a single city, who partly buys and partly himself fabricates lessons on these same subjects, and sells them, making his living from this, you would call him nothing other than what we just now said.
Of course I would.
So the part of acquisition that is exchange, whether purchase or retail or direct selling in either case, whatever learning selling business concerns such matters, you will always call, it seems, sophistic.
Necessarily, for one must follow along with the argument.
Let us look further still, to see whether the kind we are now pursuing resembles something of the following sort.
What sort?
Of the art of acquisition, there was for us a part called competitive.
Yes, there was.
Then it isn't out of place to cut this in two as well.
Say along which lines?
Setting one part of it as contest, the other as combat.
Yes.
Now for the combat that occurs body against body, it's likely fitting to give it some name such as violence.
Yes.
But for the one that pits words against words, theaetetus, what else could one call it but disputation?
Nothing else.
And the matter of disputation must be set down as twofold.
How?
Insofar as it occurs in long speeches opposed to long speeches, and concerns just and unjust things, in public, it is forensic.
Yes.
And the kind that occurs in private, broken up into questions against answers, surely we're accustomed to call this nothing but aristic.
Nothing else.
And of aristic, the part that concerns contracts in which people dispute, but do so haphazardly and without art, this must be set down as a distinct kind, since the argument has recognized it as being something separate, but it has not received a name from earlier thinkers, nor does it deserve one from us now.
True, for it is divided up into pieces too small and too various.
But the part that is done with art and disputes about just and unjust things themselves, and about other matters generally, don't we usually call this, in turn, contentious argument?
How could we not?
And of contentious argument, one part wastes money, the other makes money.
Quite so.
Then let us try to state the name that each of these two ought to be called.
We certainly must.
Well, I think that the part which, out of the sheer pleasure of spending time on such things, neglects one's own household affairs, while its manner of speaking gives most of its listeners no pleasure at all, this, in my judgment, is called nothing other than idle chatter.
Yes, it's called something like that.
Then try to state, in your turn, the opposite of this, the one that makes money from private quarrels.
And what else could one say, without error, except that this in turn is, once again, that same astonishing figure, now appearing for a fourth time the sophist we've been pursuing?
Nothing else, it seems, than that the money-making kind belonging to the art of disputation, the art of contradiction, of controversy, of combat, of contest, of acquisition, is, as our argument has now revealed once more, the sophist.
Quite so.
So you see how truly it's said that this creature is many-colored, and, as the saying goes, not to be caught with one hand.
Then we must use both.
Yes, we must, and as far as we're able we should do just that, tracking some further trace of him like this. Tell me, we have certain names for household tasks, don't we?
Many of them. But which of the many are you asking about?
Things like this, we speak of straining, sifting, winnowing, and separating.
Of course.
And besides these, also carding, combing, weaving with the shuttle, and countless other such things present in the crafts. We know these, don't we?
What point were you trying to illustrate by setting out these examples and asking about all of them together?
All the things mentioned are, I think, cases of division.
Yes.
So following my argument, since this is one single art running through all of them, we should think it worthy of one name.
What shall we call it?
Discriminative.
Let it be so.
Now look and see whether we can make out two forms of it in turn.
That's a quick inquiry you're setting me.
Well, among the divisions we mentioned, one kind separated worse from better, the other like from like.
Put that way, it does seem to be so.
Now for the second kind I have no established name, but for the division that keeps the better and throws away the worse, I do have one.
Tell me.
Every division of that sort, as I understand it, is called by everyone a kind of purification.
Yes, it is.
And wouldn't everyone see that this purifying kind is itself twofold?
Yes, given time to think, perhaps, but I don't see it right now.
Well, the many kinds of purification concerning bodies deserve to be gathered under one name.
Which ones, and what name?
Those belonging to living creatures, whatever is purified rightly from within the body by gymnastic and medicine, and concerning the outside, trivial to mention, whatever bathing provides, and those of lifeless bodies, which fulling and the whole art of adornment attend to, acquiring in their small particulars many names that seem laughable.
Very much so.
Quite so indeed, Theaetetus. But for the method of argument, it makes no more and no less difference whether sponge cleaning or medicine drinking benefits us by purifying small things or great. For in order to acquire understanding, it tries to grasp what is akin and what is not akin among all the arts, and for this purpose it honors them all equally, and considers none of the like arts more laughable than another by reason of their similarity, nor does it think someone who displays hunting through generalship more dignified than one who does so through lice catching, rather, for the most part, more pompous. And so now, too, as to what you asked, what single name we shall give to all the powers, whatever they may be, that are allotted the task of purifying a body, whether ensouled or soulless, it will make no difference to our method which term seems the most fitting. Only let it hold together, apart from the purifications of the soul, everything else that purifies anything at all. For it has now been trying to mark off the purification concerning thought from the others, if indeed we understand what it wants.
Well, I have understood. And I agree there are two kinds of purification, one being the kind concerning the soul, separate from the kind concerning the body.
Excellent in every way. Now listen to what comes next, trying again to cut what's been said in two.
Whatever direction you lead, I'll try to help you cut it.
Do we speak of some vice in the soul as distinct from virtue?
Of course.
And purification was, we said, to keep the one and cast out whatever is bad.
Yes, it was.
So too with the soul, insofar as we find some removal of badness in it, we'll be speaking in tune if we call this a purification.
Very much so.
We must speak of two kinds of badness concerning the soul.
Which two?
One like a disease in the body, the other like an ugliness that arises in it.
I didn't follow that.
Perhaps you haven't thought of disease and civil strife as the same thing.
Here, too, I don't know what I should answer.
Do you take strife to be anything other than the falling out from some corruption of things naturally akin?
Nothing else.
And is ugliness anything but the presence everywhere of the disproportionate, unshapely kind?
Nothing else at all.
Well then, haven't we noticed that in the soul, opinions are at odds with desires, spirit with pleasures, reason with pains, and all these with one another, whenever things go badly?
Very much so.
And yet all these are necessarily akin to one another.
Of course.
So we'll be right to call vice a strife and disease of the soul.
Quite right.
And what about this, whatever partakes of motion and sets itself some target, and in trying to reach it on each impulse veers off course and misses, shall we say these things suffer this from a proportion among themselves, or on the contrary from a disproportion?
Clearly, from disproportion.
But surely we know that every soul, whenever it's ignorant of anything, is ignorant against its will.
Very much so.
And to be ignorant is nothing other than this. When a soul reaching for truth has its understanding go astray, that is nothing but derangement.
Quite so.
So we must posit an unintelligent soul as ugly and disproportionate.
So it seems.
There are then, as it appears, these two kinds of evils in the soul, the one called by most people vice, which is quite clearly a disease of it.
Yes.
And the other they call ignorance, but they're unwilling to admit that, occurring only in the soul, it too is a badness.
I must fully grant now what I was puzzled about when you said it a moment ago, that there are two kinds of badness in the soul, and that cowardice, intemperance, and injustice must all be counted as a disease within us, while the affliction of extensive and manifold ignorance must be set down as ugliness.
So concerning the body, for these two afflictions there arose two arts.
Which two?
For ugliness, gymnastic, for disease, medicine.
So it appears.
And for insolence, injustice, and cowardice, isn't the art of chastisement by nature the one most fitting of all the arts, most closely related to justice?
That's likely, at least by human reckoning.
And what about this, for ignorance in general, could one more rightly name any other art than the art of teaching?
None.
Come then, must we say teaching is a single kind, or several with two of them the greatest, consider.
I'm considering.
And I think we could find out most quickly this way.
How?
By seeing whether ignorance admits of some cut down its middle. For if it turns out to be double, that clearly forces teaching too to have two parts, one for each of its kinds.
Well then, is what we're now seeking clear to you at all?
I think I see one form of ignorance that is great and hard, set apart, outweighing all its other parts together.
Which one is that?
Thinking one knows something one doesn't know at all. Through this, it seems, all the errors of thought come about for everyone.
True.
And indeed I think this alone, among the kinds of ignorance, has been given the name stupidity.
Quite so.
And what should we call the part of teaching that removes this?
Well, stranger, I think the rest should be called instruction in craft. But this one, here among us, we call education.
Yes, and pretty much among all the Greeks. But we still have this further to examine, whether it is now already indivisible, or admits some division worthy of a name.
We should look into it.
Well, I think this too still splits somehow.
In what way?
Of teaching by argument, one path seems rougher, the other part of it smoother.
What shall we call each of these?
The one is the venerable ancestral method, which people used most of all toward their sons, and many still use today, whenever their children go wrong in some way, sometimes scolding them harshly, sometimes coaxing more gently. The whole of it one would most rightly call admonition.
That's how it is.
But others, it seems, have reasoned it out for themselves and come to hold that all ignorance is involuntary, and that no one who thinks himself wise in matters he considers himself clever in would ever be willing to learn anything about them, and that this admonitory kind of education, for all its trouble, accomplishes little.
And they're right to think so.
For this reason they set out to expel that very opinion by another method.
Which one?
They question someone about the things he thinks he's saying something about when he's really saying nothing. Then, since such people's opinions wander, they easily test them, and gathering these opinions together in argument, they set them side by side, and in setting them side by side they show that they contradict each other, about the same things, in relation to the same things, in the same respect. And those who see this grow angry at themselves, but grow gentle toward others, and in this way they are freed from their great, rigid opinions about themselves. A freedom that, of all releases, is the most pleasant to hear and proves the most lasting for the one who undergoes it. For those who purify them, dear boy, hold the same view as doctors who deal with the body. Just as those doctors have held that the body cannot benefit from food offered to it until someone expels the obstructions within it, so too these thinkers judged concerning the soul, that it will not gain benefit from the learning offered to it until someone, by refuting a person, brings him to a sense of shame, removing the opinions that obstruct his learning and shows him purified, believing he knows only what he does know and no more.
That is certainly the best and most sound-minded of the states one can be in.
For all these reasons, then, Theaetetus, we must say that refutation is the greatest and most authoritative of purifications, and conversely we must consider anyone unrefuted, even if he happens to be the great king himself, as in the greatest matters unpurified, and as having become uneducated and ugly in just those respects in which the one who is truly going to be happy ought to be most pure and most beautiful.
Quite so, indeed.
Well then, what shall we call those who practice this art? I'm afraid to say sophists.
Why so?
For fear we grant them too great an honor.
But surely, what has just been said does resemble something of that sort.
Yes, just as a wolf resembles a dog, the wildest thing resembling the tamest. But the cautious man must above all keep watch concerning resemblances always, for that class of thing is most slippery. Still, let it stand, for I don't think the dispute will be over small boundary lines once people keep watch carefully enough.
No, that's not likely.
Then let there be a purifying part of the discriminative art, and within purification let the part concerning the soul be marked off, and within this, teaching, and within teaching, education. And let the refutation of empty conceit of wisdom, which has appeared to us in our present argument concerning education, be called for us nothing other than the noble sophistry, noble in its kind.
Let it be called so. But I myself am now at a loss, since so many things have come to light, as to what one should say, speaking truly and firmly, the sophist really is.
It's reasonable that you're at a loss, but we should think that by now he too must be quite at a loss as to how he'll still slip out of the argument, for the proverb is right that says it isn't easy to escape every kind of net, so now especially we must press the attack on him.
Well said.
First then let's stand still and catch our breath, so to speak, and while resting let's reckon up among ourselves how many things the sophist has turned out to be for us. For I think, first, he was found to be a paid hunter of the young and wealthy.
Yes.
And second, a kind of merchant in learning concerning the soul.
Quite so.
And third, didn't he turn up as a retailer of these same things?
Yes, and fourth he was, for us, one who sells his own wares directly concerning learning.
You remembered rightly, and I'll try to remember the fifth. He was a kind of athlete in the contest of arguments, having marked off for himself the art of disputation.
Yes, he was.
The sixth is disputable, but even so we set it down, granting him to be a purifier of the soul from opinions that obstruct learning.
Quite so, indeed.
Do you notice this? When someone appears knowledgeable about many things but is called by the name of a single skill, there's something unsound about that impression. It's clear that the person forming this impression can't make out the one thing in that skill toward which all these various branches of learning point, which is why he addresses the person who has them by many names instead of one.
That does seem to be roughly how it works.
Then let's not let laziness produce the same effect on us in our own inquiry. Let's pick up again one of the things we said about the sophist. There was one point in particular that struck me as revealing him.
Which point?
We said he was a controversialist, a man skilled in arguing both sides.
Yes.
And also that he makes others into the same sort of arguer.
Of course.
Let's look then at what exactly such men claim to make people skilled at arguing about. Let our inquiry proceed from the beginning along these lines. Take divine matters, the things hidden from most people. Do they make people capable of arguing both sides about those?
Well, that's certainly what's said about them.
And what about visible things, the earth, the sky, and everything connected with them?
Of course, that too.
And in private conversations, whenever something is said about coming to be and being in a general way, we know that they themselves are formidable at arguing the opposite view, and that they make others just as capable.
Absolutely.
And what about laws and political matters generally? Don't they promise to produce men able to dispute any position?
No one would even talk to them, so to speak, if they didn't promise that.
And as for the arguments to be raised against every craftsman, in every single craft and in all of them together, these have surely been written down and published for anyone who wants to learn them.
You seem to be referring to the Protagorean writings on wrestling and the other crafts.
Yes, my friend, and many others besides. But isn't the whole point of this art of argument both ways, in some single capacity sufficient for disputing about everything?
Well, it certainly looks as though it leaves nothing out.
But by the gods, my boy, do you really think that's possible? Perhaps you young people see this more sharply than we do, and we see it more dimly.
What do you mean, and what exactly are you asking? I don't quite follow the question just now.
Whether it's possible for any human being to know everything.
If it were, stranger, our race would be a blessed one indeed.
Then how could anyone, being himself ignorant, manage to say anything sound in opposition to someone who actually knows?
There's no way.
So what could be so wonderful about the sophist's supposed power?
What are you asking about?
The way they manage to give young people the impression that they themselves are the wisest of all men on all subjects. Clearly, if they didn't argue correctly, or if they did but didn't appear to their listeners to be doing so, or if even appearing to, they still weren't thought any wiser on account of their disputing, then, as you say, hardly anyone would ever be willing to pay them money to become their students.
Hardly, indeed.
But as it stands, people are willing.
Very much so.
Because they're thought, I imagine, to have real knowledge of the very things they argue about.
Of course.
And they do this about everything we're saying.
Yes.
So they appear to their students as wise about everything.
Naturally.
Though not actually being so, for that turned out to be impossible.
How could it be otherwise?
So the sophist has turned out for us to possess some sort of opinion-based knowledge about everything, but not the truth.
Absolutely, and it looks like what's just been said is exactly right about them.
Let's take a clearer example to illustrate this.
What sort?
This one, and try to pay close attention and answer well.
About what?
Suppose someone claimed that he could, not by speaking or arguing, but by making and doing, know how to produce all things by a single craft.
What do you mean by all things?
You're already missing the start of what I said. It seems you don't grasp all things as a whole.
No, I don't.
I mean you and me among all things, and along with us the other animals and the trees.
What do you mean?
Suppose someone claimed he would make me and you and all the other living things as well.
What sort of making are you talking about? You surely can't mean some kind of farmer. You also said he'd be a maker of animals.
I do mean that, and more, a maker of sea and earth and sky and gods and everything else besides. And what's more, he makes each of these quickly and sells them all for a very small price.
You're describing some kind of joke.
And what about the man who says he knows everything and could teach it to someone else for a small fee and in a short time? Shouldn't that too be considered a joke?
Absolutely, I'd think.
And do you know of any form of playful trickery more skillful or more charming than the art of imitation?
Not at all. You've named a form that gathers an enormous range of things into one, and about the most versatile kind there is.
Then we recognize that the man who promises to be able to make everything by one craft, by producing likenesses and namesakes of the things that exist through the art of drawing, will be able, by showing his drawings from a distance, to deceive foolish young children into thinking that whatever he wishes to do, he's fully capable of actually accomplishing.
Of course.
And what about this? Shouldn't we expect there to be some other craft concerning speeches, by which it's likewise possible to bewitch the young through their ears with words, while they're still standing far off from the truth of things, by presenting spoken images of everything, so as to make what's said seem true, and the speaker himself seem the wisest of all men on every subject?
Why shouldn't there be some such craft?
Then isn't it necessary, Theaetetus, that most of those who listen to such things back then, once enough time has passed and they've grown older, and they come up against realities close at hand, and are forced through direct experience to grasp clearly what actually exists, that they change the opinions they held back then, so that great things now appear small and easy things difficult, and all the images conjured up in speeches are utterly overturned by the things that actually happen in practice?
Yes, as far as I, at my age, can judge. I suppose I too am still among those standing far off from it.
That's exactly why all of us here will try, and are trying right now, to bring you as close as possible without the actual experience. So tell me this about the sophist. Is it already clear that he's one of these enchanters, an imitator of real things, or are we still uncertain whether he actually possesses true knowledge of all the subjects he seems capable of arguing about?
How could that be, stranger? It's already fairly clear from what's been said that he's one of the participants in this playful trickery.
Then we must set him down as some kind of enchanter and imitator.
How could we not?
Come then, our job now is not to let the quarry loose any longer. We've pretty much surrounded him in a kind of net woven from arguments about such matters, so that he won't escape this much at least.
Escape what?
The conclusion that he's one of the tribe of wonder workers.
I agree with that much about him too.
It's decided then that we should as quickly as possible divide the art of image making, and once we've descended into it, if the sophist waits for us right away, we'll seize him according to the instructions of the royal argument and hand him over, displaying our catch. But if he slips down into some subdivision of the art of imitation, we'll follow along, always dividing the part that receives him until he's caught. In no case will he or any other kind ever be able to boast that it escaped a method capable of pursuing things both one by one and all together.
Well said. That's exactly what we should do.
Following the method of division we've used so far, I think I can now make out two forms of the art of imitation, but which of the two contains the form we're hunting for, I don't yet think I can determine.
Well, tell us first, and distinguish the two you mean.
One I see in it is the art of likeness making. This occurs above all whenever someone produces a copy by following the proportions of the model in length, breadth, and depth, and further assigns to each part the colors that properly belong to it.
But don't all imitators try to do this?
Not those who model or draw any of the large works. If they were to reproduce the true proportions of beautiful things, you know that the upper parts would appear too small and the lower parts too large, because we see the one from a distance and the other from close up.
Quite so.
So don't craftsmen, letting the truth go, actually work into their images not the real proportions, but those that will seem beautiful?
Absolutely.
Then isn't it fair to call the one thing, since it's like its model, a likeness?
Yes.
And shouldn't the part of imitation concerned with this be called, as we said before, the art of likeness making?
It should.
And what about the thing that appears, because of the way it's viewed rather than from a good vantage point, to resemble the beautiful, but which, if someone gained the power to see such large things properly, wouldn't even resemble the thing it claims to resemble? What do we call that? Since it appears but doesn't resemble, isn't it an apparition?
Of course.
And isn't this a very large part, both in painting and throughout the whole of imitation?
How could it not be?
Then wouldn't we most correctly call the art that produces an apparition, rather than a likeness, the art of appearance making?
Very much so.
These, then, were the two forms I meant of the image-making art, likeness-making and appearance-making.
Correctly put.
But the thing I was unsure of before, in which of the two we should place the sophist, I still can't see clearly even now. The man really is astonishing and extremely hard to pin down, since even now he's escaped very neatly and cleverly into a form that's hard to investigate.
So it seems.
Do you agree because you actually understand this, or has some momentum of the argument, from sheer habit, swept you along into agreeing quickly?
What do you mean by that, and what's it about?
We really are, my friend, in an altogether difficult inquiry. This business of appearing and seeming without being, and of saying things that aren't true, all of this has always been full of perplexity, both in the past and now. How one is to say that falsehood really exists, either in speech or in belief, and in saying so avoid being caught in a self-contradiction, that theaetetus is thoroughly difficult.
How is that?
This argument has dared to assume that what is, not is, for otherwise falsehood could never have come to be. But great Parmenides, my boy, when we were children, testified against this from beginning to end, saying it again and again, both in plain speech and in verse, for never shall this be forced through, that things that are not are, but you in your inquiry hold your thought back from this path. So it is testified to by him, and the argument itself, if we press it a little, would show this most clearly of all. Let us look at this very point first, if it makes no difference to you.
Do with me whatever you like. Just look for whatever path the argument runs best along, and lead me by that same road.
Then that is what we must do. Tell me, do we dare to utter the phrase, what in no way is?
Of course we do.
Well then, not for the sake of dispute or play, but suppose one of our listeners had to stop and think seriously and answer, to what should this name, what is not, be applied? What do we suppose we ourselves would use it for, and what would we point to in showing it to someone who asked?
That's a hard question you've asked, and pretty much impossible for someone like me altogether.
Well, this much at least is clear. What is not cannot be attached to any of the things that are.
How could it be?
So then, since it cannot be attached to what is, no one could rightly attach it to something either.
How do you mean?
This too is plain to us, surely, that whenever we say something, we always say it of something that is. For to say it all alone, bare and stripped away from all the things that are, is impossible, isn't that so?
Impossible.
Do you agree, looking at it this way, that whoever says something must be saying some one thing?
Yes.
For you will say that something is a sign of one thing, and some two of two, and some several of many.
Of course.
And whoever says nothing at all as something must, it seems, necessarily be saying nothing whatsoever.
Quite necessarily.
So must we not even grant this much, that such a person says something, yet says nothing, but rather say he isn't even speaking at all, if he attempts to utter the words, what is not?
Well then, the argument would have reached the very end of its perplexity.
Don't say anything so grand yet, my blessed friend, for there is still more, and this is in fact the greatest and the very first of the difficulties. It happens to concern the very starting point of the matter.
What do you mean? Speak, and don't hold back at all.
To what is, presumably, something else that is could be added?
Of course.
But to what is not, shall we ever say that any of the things that are could be added?
How could it?
We reckon number as a whole among the things that are, don't we?
Yes, if indeed anything else is to be reckoned as being.
Then let us not even attempt to bring either a plurality of number or a single unit up against what is not.
We would not, it seems, be attempting that rightly, according to what the argument says.
Then how could anyone either utter with his mouth, or even grasp in thought at all, the things that are not, or what is not apart from number?
Tell me how you mean.
When we speak of things that are not, plural, aren't we attempting to add a plurality of number?
Certainly.
And when we say what is not, singular, aren't we adding the unit instead?
Quite clearly so.
And yet we say it is neither just nor right to attempt to fit what is onto what is not.
What you say is very true.
Do you see then that it is not possible to utter correctly, nor to speak, nor to think what is not all by itself, but that it is unthinkable, unspeakable, unutterable, and without account?
Quite so.
Was I wrong then, just now, in saying I would state the greatest difficulty about it? Do we have some other one still greater to mention?
What one is that?
My wonderful friend, don't you see, from the very things that have been said, that what is not throws even the man refuting it into such difficulty that whenever anyone tries to refute it, he is forced to contradict himself about it.
What do you mean? Say it more clearly still.
There's no need to look for anything clearer in me, for I myself, having laid it down that what is not must have no share in either one or the many, just now and even now spoke of it as one, for I said what is not. You follow, I take it.
Yes.
And again, only a moment ago, I said it was unutterable, unspeakable, and without account. Do you follow? So then wasn't I saying things contrary to what I said before, when I tried to attach being to it?
You appear to be.
And what's more, in attaching that, wasn't I speaking of it as if it were one thing?
Yes.
And indeed, when I called it without account, unspeakable and unutterable, I was treating my discourse as directed at one single thing.
Of course you were.
But we say that if one is to speak correctly, one must mark it off neither as one nor as many, nor even call it it at all, for by that very designation it would be addressed under the form of the one.
Quite so.
Well then, what could anyone say about me? For he would find me defeated, both long ago and now, on the subject of refuting what is not. So don't let us look, as I said, to my own speech for correct usage concerning what is not come. Let us instead examine the matter in you.
What do you mean?
Come, make a fine and noble attempt for us, since you're young, and strain every nerve you can, and try, without attaching either being, or the one, or a plurality of number to what is not, to say something correct about it.
A great and strange eagerness would have to seize me for the attempt, if seeing you suffering as you do, I should try it myself.
Well, if you like, let's leave you and me out of it. But until we meet someone able to do this, let us say that the sophist has, more than anything, cunningly sunk himself down into a place with no way out.
It certainly does appear so.
And so, if we say he possesses some art of image-making, he will easily seize on that very use of words against us and turn our arguments back the other way, whenever we call him an image-maker, by asking us just what in the world we mean at all by image. So we must consider, Theaetetus, what one is to answer the young man in response to his question.
Clearly we shall say the images in water, and in mirrors, and further the painted and moulded ones, and all the other such things there are of that kind.
It's plain, Theaetetus, that you haven't seen a sophist.
How so?
He'll seem to you to be shutting his eyes, or to have no eyes at all.
How do you mean?
When you give him that answer, if you speak of things in mirrors or in sculpted works, he will laugh at your words, since you speak to him as if he could see, pretending he knows nothing of mirrors or water or sight at all, and he will question you only on the basis of your own words.
What sort of question?
The one running through all these things which, though you named many, you thought fit to call by one name, speaking of image, as applying to them all as though it were one thing. So speak and defend yourself, giving no ground to the man.
Then what, stranger, should we say an image is, except another thing of the same sort, made to resemble the true one?
Do you mean another true thing of that sort, or what do you mean by of that sort?
Not true at all, but merely like it.
Do you mean by the true what really is?
Yes.
And is the not true, then, the opposite of the true?
Of course.
So you're saying that the likeness really is not, if indeed you're going to say it is not true.
But it does exist, in some way.
Not truly, though, you say.
No, not that. Except that it really is a likeness.
So it is not, yet really is, this thing we call a likeness.
It looks as if what is not has gotten woven together with what is in some such tangle, and a very strange one at that.
Of course it's strange. You can see at any rate that even now, through this interweaving, the many-headed sophist has forced us, against our will, to admit that what is not somehow is.
I see it very clearly.
Well then, how are we going to mark off his art in such a way that we can agree with ourselves?
In what way, and what are you afraid of, that you speak like this?
When we say he deceives people about appearance, and that his art is a kind of deceiving art, shall we say that our soul holds false beliefs because of his art, or what shall we say?
That, what else could we say?
And false belief, in turn, will be believing the opposite of the things that are, won't it?
Yes, the opposite.
So you're saying that false belief believes things that are not?
Necessarily.
Does it believe that the things that are not, or in some way that the things that in no way are?
The things that are not must in some way be, if anyone is ever going to be false about anything, even a little.
What then, isn't it also believed that the things that altogether are not?
Yes.
And is this too falsehood?
This too.
And a false statement, I think, will be judged false in just the same way, one that says the things that are not, and the things that are not are.
How else could it become such a thing?
Hardly any other way, but the sophist will not admit this. Or what device is there for any sensible man to agree, once it has already been agreed beforehand that these things are unutterable, unspeakable, without account, and unthinkable? Do we understand, Theaetetus, what he means?
Of course we understand that he'll say we're saying the opposite of what we just said, when we dare to assert that falsehood exists among beliefs and in statements, since we're forced, over and over, to attach being to what is not, though we just now agreed together that this was the most impossible thing of all.
You've remembered rightly, but now consider what we ought to do about the sophist, for you see how ready to hand and how numerous are the objections and difficulties, if we go hunting for him, by placing him in the art of those who work falsehood and deceive by tricks.
Very much so.
And yet we've only gone through a small portion of them, when they are, so to speak, endless.
It would be impossible, then it seems, to catch the sophist, if this is how things stand.
What then, shall we now grow soft and back off?
No, I say we must not, if we're still able to get some grip on the man, even a small one.
Then will you forgive me and be content, as you just said, if we manage somehow to pull ourselves free, even a little, from so strong an argument?
Of course I will.
Then I beg one more thing of you, even more.
What is that?
Don't take me for some kind of father killer.
Why do you say that?
In defending ourselves, we shall be forced to test Father Parmenides' argument, and to force through the claim both that what is not in some way is, and that what is in turn in some way is not.
It's clear that this is a point we must fight for in the argument.
Of course it's clear even to a blind man, as the saying goes. For until these things are either refuted or agreed to, hardly anyone will ever be able to speak about false statements or false belief, whether of images or likenesses or imitations or appearances themselves, or of the arts concerned with these, without being forced to contradict himself and become an object of ridicule.
Very true.
For these reasons, then, we must dare to lay hands on our father's teaching now, or else abandon the attempt altogether, if some scruple is holding us back from doing it.
No, let nothing hold us back from that, not in the least.
Then there's a third small favor I'll ask of you.
Just say it.
I said a moment ago that when it comes to examining this question, I've always been at a loss, and I still am now.
You did say that.
Well, I'm afraid that after saying this you'll think me a madman, suddenly turning myself upside down and inside out for no reason. For it's for your sake that we're going to take on the examination of this claim, if we're going to examine it at all.
As far as that goes, you won't seem to me to be doing anything out of line if you proceed to this examination and demonstration. So go ahead with confidence.
Well then, where should one begin such a risky argument? I think, my boy, this is the path we're most bound to take.
Which one?
To look first at the things that now seem obvious to us, in case we've actually gotten muddled about them, and are too readily agreeing with each other that we see them clearly.
Say more plainly what you mean.
It seems to me that Parmenides, and everyone else who's ever set out to determine by argument how many things there are, and of what sort, has talked to us rather too casually.
How so?
Each of them seems to me to be telling us some story, as if we were children. One says the things that are three, and that certain of them sometimes make war on each other, and sometimes become friends and produce marriages and births and the rearing of offspring. Another says there are two, wet and dry or hot and cold, and marries them off and gives them away. And our own Eleatic tribe, starting from Xenophanes and even earlier, tells its tales on the assumption that what we call all things is really one. Then some later Donian and Sicilian muses realized that it was safest to weave the two together, and to say that being is both many and one, held together by hatred and love.